Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota on Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit toyotaonnicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com.
And a happy St. Patrick's Day to all of you, and especially you sitting there. This is Setting the Record Straight, on the BreadboxMedia.com, no less. You know me, I'm Charles Robert Patrick O'Cachlan, ready to talk to you about how the Irish saved us all, especially the Irish monks. Yes, the monks. Okay, this is Chuck Coughlin. I'm going to relieve you of listening to that brogue. How did the Irish monks save us? Well, they saved us from being ruled by the Muslims. How did they save us from being ruled by the Muslims? They gave us two gifts, something to fight for and something to fight with. I will tell you at the end of this program just what these two gifts of the monks were. This program is an attempt to uncover again the glorious and magnificent history of the Catholic Church, so much of it unjustly neglected. In recent years, we've been treated to repetition after repetition of things wrong with our Catholic Church. But there is so much more that is right about it, and its glorious history needs to be known. It's sometimes said that the Irish saved civilization by restoring literacy to Europe. One of the more laughable accusations against the Catholic Church is it discouraged the reading of the Bible. Well, how do you read the Bible unless you can read? It's the Catholic Church that taught Europe to read. And taught Europe to read by reading the Bible. The first German and the first English Bibles were Catholic Bibles. Gutenberg was a Catholic. The Bible he printed over 70 years before Martin Luther inspired the Protestant revolt was the Vulgate, the Catholic Bible. But my story now begins centuries before that. Western Europe went through centuries of disorder and widespread illiteracy in what has been called the Dark Ages. Although a network of monasteries maintained civilization where they could, where they were not sacked by the barbarian, as were the great cities of Rome. In any event, literacy and culture took a giant backstep, and much of the culture of former times was lost. So Western Europe endured the Dark Ages. After the fall of the Roman Empire, an empire in which 10% of the people were literate, about 7.5 million people, the total population of the empire was around 75 million. There's lessons for us today in the fall of the Roman Empire. Have you heard what caused this collapse? Are you wondering? Well, I'll list a few of the factors so they ought to be familiar to us. They sadly describe our country today. The creation of an unwieldy and rigid bureaucracy, whose own survival became its overriding goal, thus making its upper ranks an unprecedented opportunity for marginal men to whom its ranks had once been closed. The despising of the military and the avoidance of its service by established families and the elite. The changing character of the native population brought about through pressures on porous borders. The lip service paid to values long dead. The pretense of a proud people pretending that they still were what they once were. The increasing concentration of the populace into richer and poorer. The aggrandizement of executive power at the expense of the legislature. Ineffectual legislation promulgated with great show, but most notably, the breakdown of the families due to a decrease in sexual virtue, the increased use of abortion and infanticide. Families became smaller and smaller. Marital fidelity suffered. These are all themes with which our world is familiar. Nor are they the God-given property of any party. It must be said that the Roman emperor could not heap his economic burdens on posterity by creating long-term public debt, for floating capital had not yet been conceptualized. Yes, we can look back on the wild instability of the Roman Empire in its final days and reflect on it. But it was not easy for the Romans. The Eternal City had been untouchable since the Celts of Gaul had sacked it by surprise in 390 BC. In the ensuing 8 centuries, Rome built itself into the world's only superpower, unassailable except for the occasional war on distant borders. The Gauls, in what is now France, had long since become civilized Romans, and Rome offered the same Romanization to anyone who wanted it. Normally, though, everyone was dying to be Roman. As Theodoric, the king of the Ostrogoths, was fond of saying, "An able Goth wants to be like a Roman. Only a poor Roman would want to be like a Goth." The citizens of Rome, therefore, could not believe it when, toward the end of the first decade of the 5th century, they woke up to find Alaric, king of the Visigoths, and all his forces parked at their gates. He was regarded as a king of a primitive and backward people that civilized people looked down their noses upon. It was preposterous. They dispatched a pair of envoys to conduct the tiresome negotiation and send him away. The envoys began with empty threats. Any attack on Rome would be doomed, for it would be met by invincible strength and innumerable ranks of warriors. Now, Alaric was a sharp man, and in his fashion a just one. He also had a sense of humor. "The thicker the grass, more easily scythed," he replied. The envoys quickly recognized that their man was no fool. "All right, then, what's the price of the departure?" Alaric told him the price. His men would sweep through the city, taking all gold, all silver, and everything of value that could be moved. They would also round up and cart off every barbarian slave. Well, the hysterical envoys protested, "What will you leave us?" Alaric paused and looked at him, and then replied, "Your lives." In that pause, Roman security died, and a new world was conceived. Yes, they kept their lives, but their progeny lost almost everything else: titles, property, way of life, learning, especially learning. A world in chaos is not a world in which books are copied and libraries maintained. It is not a world where learned men have leisure to become more learned. It is not a world for which the school schedules regular classes of young scholars, and knowledge is dutifully transmitted year by placid year. So Alaric sacked Rome in 410. The last Western emperor died in 476. Then the Roman Imperium became increasingly unstable, and gradually Rome crumbled. The splendor of its public buildings brought down before the destructiveness of private greed. Private landowners used the great public edifices, quarries, for private palaces. And bit by bit, Rome fell. If you've seen the movie Mad Max, you've got a picture of what it would be like. What was lost when Roman Empire fell? What we would call classical civilization ended. We all know the story of St. Patrick, a Roman citizen, a Catholic boy, who was kidnapped by the pagans of Ireland, held as a shepherd's slave for years. He escaped and made it back to his family. He was welcomed home by his parents, who begged him not to go off anywhere and leave them again. But by this time, Patrick, or Patricius as he was called in Rome, is no longer a carefree Roman teenager, hardened physically and psychologically by unshareable experiences, hopelessly behind his peers in education. He could not settle down. A man he knew in Ireland visited him one night in a vision, Victoricus, who was holding countless letters. At that moment, he heard the voice of a multitude crying, "We beg you to come and walk among us once more." "Stabbed in the heart," he said. He was unable to read further and woke up. He could not put the Irish out of his mind. The visions increased, and Christ began to speak with him. "He who gave life for you, he it is who speaks within you." When Patricius could hold out no longer, he left his family once more and followed his voices to Gaul, where he received a theological education in preparation for ordination. At length, he is ordained priest and bishop. According to Cahill, virtually the first missionary bishop is after the Apostle Paul, who was also appointed in a vision. Patrick may be the second such appointment. In his mission to Ireland, St. Patrick succeeded beyond measure. Within his lifetime, or soon after his death, the Irish slave trade came to a halt, and other forms of violence, such as murder and intertribal warfare, decreased. St. Patrick's emotional grasp of Christian truth may have been greater than even St. Augustine's, says Cahill. Augustine looked into his own heart and found there the inexpressible anguish of each individual, which enabled him to articulate a theory of sin that has no equal. Patrick prayed, made peace with God, and looked then not only into his own heart, but into the hearts of others. What he saw convinced him of the bright side, that even slave traders can turn into liberators, even murderers can act as peacemakers, and even barbarians can take their place among the nobility of heaven. In becoming an Irishman, Patrick wedded his world to theirs, his faith to their life. Patrick found a way of swimming down to the depths of the Irish psyche and warming and transforming Irish imagination, making it more humane and more noble while keeping it Irish. Patrick devoted the last 30 years of his life, from roughly his late 40s to his late 70s, to his warrior children, the Irish, that they might, quote, seize the everlasting kingdoms with all the energy intensity they had lately devoted to killing and enslaving one another and seizing one another's kingdoms. This 30-year span of Patrick's mission in the middle of the 5th century encompasses a period of change so rapid and extreme that Europe may never see its like again. By 461, the likely year that St. Patrick died, the Roman Empire was careening into chaos, barely 15 years away from the death of the last Western emperor. At the moment that the Roman lands went from peace into chaos, the land of Ireland was rushing even more rapidly from chaos to peace. How did Patrick do it? His steadfast loyalty and supernatural generosity must have moved them deeply. He had transmuted their pagan virtues of loyalty, courage, and generosity into the Catholic equivalents of faith, hope, and charity. But this would not necessarily have won converts. Throughout the Roman world, Catholicism had accompanied Romanization. Its spread throughout the empire cannot be understood apart from Romanization. Just as the subject people had wanted to be Roman, they had wanted to be Catholic too. Once the Roman emperor had conferred on Catholicism its position of privilege, most Romans had little difficulty in reading this sign of the times for what it was, in grasping that their own best interest lay in membership in the Catholic Church. St. Patrick's gift to the Irish was his Catholicism, a Catholicism that completely inculcated itself into the Irish scene. Through the Edict of Milan, which had legalized this new religion in 313, Catholicism had been received into Rome, not Rome into Catholicism. But in St. Patrick's exchange, Ireland, lacking the power and traditions of Rome, had been received into Catholicism, which transformed Ireland into something new, something never seen before. A Catholic culture where slavery and human sacrifice became unthinkable, and warfare, though impossible for humans to eradicate, diminished markedly. The Irish, in any case, loved physical combat too much for intertribal warfare to disappear entirely. But new laws influenced by gospel norms inhibited such conflicts severely by requiring that arms be taken up only for a weighty cause. Unlike the Continental Church Fathers, the Irish never troubled themselves over much about eradicating pagan influences, which they tended to wink at and enjoy. Centuries later, Edmund Campion, the Elizabethan Jesuit who was martyred by the Anglicans in 1581, left us a description of the Irish that rings true to this day. It reads, "The people are thus inclined, religious, frank, amorous, ireful, sufferable of pains infinite, very glorious, many sorcerers, excellent horsemen, delighted with wares, great almsgiver, surpassing in hospitality. They are sharp-witted, lovers of learning, capable of any study whereunto they bend themselves, constant in travail, adventurous, intractable, kind-hearted, secret in displeasure." Well, whether or not Freud was right when he muttered in exasperation that the Irish were the only people who could not be helped by psychoanalysis, there could be no doubt of one thing. The Irish will never change. One element in Campion's description that I want to emphasize, lovers of learning, capable of any study whereunto they bend themselves. For it was St. Patrick's mission that nourished our scholarship into blossom. Patrick, the incomplete Roman, nevertheless understood that though Catholicism was not inextricably wedded to Roman custom, it could not survive without Roman literacy. So the first Irish Christians also became the first Irish literates. Now, Ireland is unique in religious history for being the only land in which Christianity was introduced without bloodshed. There are no Irish martyrs, at least not until the falsely praised Elizabeth I, Queen of England, began to martyr the Irish 11 centuries after Patrick. And this lack of martyrdom troubled the Irish, to whom a glorious death by violence presented such an exciting finale. If all Ireland had received Catholicism without a fight, the Irish would just have to think up some new form of martyrdom. They found a solution in the 5th century. It was called the Green Martyrdom, opposing it to the conventional red martyrdom by blood. The green martyrs are those who, leaving behind the comforts and pleasures of ordinary human society, retreated to the woods or to a mountaintop or to a lonely island, to one of the green no man's lands just outside the tribal jurisdictions, there to study the scriptures and commune with God. For among the story collections Patrick gave them, they found examples of the anchorites of the Egyptian desert, who, also lacking the purification rite of persecution, had lately devised a new form of holiness by becoming hermits, by living alone, braving all kinds of physical and psychological adversity, imposing upon themselves the most heroic fasts and penances, all for the sake of drawing near to God. There's a charming poem in Irish. It says, "Grant me, sweet Christ, the grace to find, Son of the living God, a small hut in a lonesome spot, to make it my abode." But in this verse, the saintly recluse does not intend to wall himself off from intercourse with fellow human beings. A little out of the way, he'll still be available to those who walk the extra mile. The second stanza says, "A little pool, but very clear, to stand beside the place where all men's sins are washed away by sanctifying grace. A pleasant woodland all about, to shield the hut from the wind and make a home for the singing birds before it and behind. A southern aspect for the heat, a stream along its foot, a smooth green lawn with rich topsoil, propitious to all fruit." Having established himself as a local guru, this typical hermit was soon joined by like-minded seekers who wished to build their own huts and sit at the master's feet. "My choice of men to live with me and pray to God as well, quiet men of humble mind, their number I shall tell. 4 files of 3 and 3 of 4, to give the psalter forth, 6 to pray by the south church wall, and 6 along the north. 2 by 2 my dozen friends to tell the number right, praying with me to move the king who gives the sun its light." In this verse, the Irish who'd always been fascinated by numbers and their magical properties thought 12, the biblical number that signifies completeness, to be the right count for a religious community. The humble hermit, who began by asking for so little, is now, at the end of his verse, the abbot of a monastery of men who live in small beehive-shaped huts surrounding a conventional church. Thus, there is a further request, as the poem goes on. "A lovely church, a home for God, bedecked with linen fine, where over the white gospel page the gospel candles shine." Well, having come this far, the hermit perceived the need for a common dwelling, for functions. But this building is still diminutive. "A little house where all may dwell, and body's care be sought, where none shows lust or arrogance, and none thinks an evil thought." So, in the final verse, we catch a glimpse of monastic culture in full swing, the bustling, wealthy, untaxed, center of new Irish civilization. "And all I ask for housekeeping I get and pay no fees, leeks from the garden poultry game, salmon, trout, and bees. My share of clothing and of food from the king of fairest face, and I to sit at times alone and pray in every place." That is known as the Hermit's Song. The ideal extreme of the green martyrdom was abandoned in favor of monasticism, a movement which, though it could support and even nurture oddity and eccentricity, subjected such tendencies to a social contract. Since Ireland had no cities, these monasteries grew rapidly into the first population centers, hubs of unprecedented prosperity, art, and learning. They could correctly be described as university cities. And the Irish had always been heroically hospitable, so they turned no one away, as is confirmed in this description of a typical university city by the Venerable Bede, the first historian of the emerging English people. It reads, "Many of the nobles of the English nation and lesser men also had set out thither, forsaking their native island, either for the grace of sacred learning or for a more austere life. And some of them dedicated themselves faithfully to the monastic life. Others rejoiced rather to give themselves to learning, going about from one master cell to another. All of these the Irish willingly received, and saw to it to supply them with food day by day without cost, and books for their studies, and teaching free of charge. So the Irish monastic universities accepted commoners as well as noblemen, and those who wished for learning, but not the cloister. The generosity of the Irish extended to a variety of ideas. Once they had learned to read the Gospels and the other books of the Holy Bible, the lives of the martyrs and ascetics, the sermons and commentaries of the fathers of the church, they began to devour all of the old Greek and Latin pagan literature, everything that came their way. In their unrestrained Catholicity of taste, they shocked conventional churchmen, who had been trained to value Christian literature principally, and give wide berth to the dubious morality of the pagan classics. It was not that the Irish were uncritical, just that they saw no value in self-imposed censorship. One church historian said, "It was precisely the breadth and richness of Irish monastic learning, derived from classical authors, that was about to give Ireland its unique role in the history of Western culture." It is thanks to these scribes that we have the rich trove of early Irish literature, the earliest vernacular literature of Europe to survive, because it was taken seriously enough to be written down. Though these early Irish literates were intensely interested in the worlds opened up to them by the three sacred languages of Greek, Latin, and in rudimentary form Hebrew, they loved their own tongue too, Gaelic, without ever stopping to use it, whereas elsewhere in Europe no educated man would be caught dead speaking a vernacular. The Irish thought that all language was a game, and too much fun to be deprived of any part of it. These were happy human beings, occasionally waspish, but normally filled with delight at the tasks their fate set for them. They did not see themselves as drones. Rather, they engaged the text they were working on, tried to comprehend it after their fashion, and if possible, add to it, improve on it. In this dazzling new culture, a book was not an isolated document on a dusty shelf. Book truly spoke to book, and writer to scribe, and scribe to reader, from one generation to the next. We might say today that these books were interfacing, intertextual. The Irish enshrined literacy as their central religious act. In a land where literacy had previously been unknown, in a world where the old literate civilizations were sinking fast, the white gospel page, shining in all the little oratories of Ireland, acting as a pledge, the lonely darkness had been turned into light, and the lonely virtue of courage, sustained throughout all the centuries, had been transformed into hope. The only alphabet these people had ever known was prehistoric Ogham, a cumbersome set of lines based on the Roman alphabet. But now they combined the stately letters of the Greek and Roman alphabets with the talismanic, spellbinding simplicity of Ogham to produce initial capital letters and headings that rivet one's eyes to the page and hold the reader in awe. They found the shapes of letters magical. Why, they asked themselves, did a bee look the way it did? Could it look some other way? Was there an essential bee-ness? The result of such why is the sky blue question was a new kind of book, the Irish Codex. And one after another, Ireland began to produce the most spectacular magical books the world has ever seen. The Book of Kells has been called the work of an angel, not of a man. And what they made of the monogram of Christ, the Cairo, has been called more a presence than letters. For the body of the text, the Irish developed two hands, one dignified but rounded script called Irish half-unicil, the other an easy-to-write script called Irish minuscule. It was more readable, fluid, well, happier than anything that was devised by the Romans. It became the common script everywhere of the Middle Ages. Now, you probably know that the word codex is a synonym for book. That word was originally used to distinguish a book from its ancestor, the scroll. By this time, the codex had universally displaced the scroll. The pages of most books were of mottled parchment, that is, dried sheepskin, which was universally available in Ireland, whose bright green fields still host each April an explosion of new white lambs. Vellum, or calfskin, which was more uniformly white when dried, was used more sparingly, only for the most honored texts. It's interesting to note that the shape of the modern book, taller than wide, was determined by the dimension of a sheepskin, which could most economically be cut into double pages that yield our modern book shape when folded. The scribe transcribed the text onto pages gathered into a booklet called a quire, later stitched with other quires into a larger volume, which was then sometimes bound between protecting covers. It should astonish everyone that these decorated Irish manuscripts of the early medieval period are today the great jewels of libraries all over Europe, in England, France, Switzerland, Germany, Sweden, Italy, and even Russia. How did they get there? The answer lies with the greatest Irish figure after Patrick, Columbkeel, Prince of Clan Conall, born in the royal enclosure of Gartan in 521. 90 years after Patrick's arrival in Ireland. A man of great abilities, Columbkeel could have been a king, maybe even a high king, but he chose to become a monk. The Latinized version of his name is Columba. You may know him as St. Columba. He was an intense man. He loved beautiful things, the heritage, no doubt, of his privileged childhood. He loved to travel. He was educated in the bardic traditions of his ancestors. And then in the new traditions of Christian learning, he journeyed as far as Gaul to visit the tomb of St. Martin of Tours, whose sensible monastic rule was finding favor on the continent. Men often wished to escape the increasing uncertainties of an age of upheaval. Returning to Ireland, the energetic Columbkeel began founding monasteries at Duro, Kells, and many other places. By the time he was 41, 41 Irish foundations could claim him as a royal patron. He especially loved Derry, angel-haunted Derry, he called it, where he founded his first monastery, even before his pilgrimage to Tours, and of which he sang in sensuous poetry that can stand beside any in the early Irish canon. But if Columbkeel loved anything more than his native place, he loved books, especially beautifully designed manuscripts. As a student, he had fallen in love with his master Psalter, a uniquely decorated book worth a great deal. He resolved to make his own copy. He had to do it by stealth, so he went at night, sitting in Finian's church at Moville, hunched over the coveted Psalter, copying it in the dark. According to Irish legend, he had no candle, but the five fingers of his left hand shone out like so many lights, while his right hand assiduously copied. This legend is embellished with many such details. But it is historically true that he was brought before King Diadamate, who issued his famous decision, quote, "To every cow her calf, to every book its copy." It was history's first copyright case. To every cow her calf, to every book its copy. Columbkeel, forced to return the copy to Finian, was too much the aristocratic pagan to forget this humiliation. When sometime later one of Columbkeel's followers was killed on this same king's orders, the princely monk seized his opportunity. God, he claimed, who protected all monks, had to be avenged. Mobilizing his powerful kinsmen, he took the field against King Diadamant's forces and beat them decisively. When the clash of battle had subsided, 3,001 lay dead. Only one of them on princely Columbkeel's side. The contested Psalter, which, needless to say, came to Columbkeel among the spoils of victory, was ever after called the Cetach, or warrior. But Columbkill's victory had less pleasant consequences for him. For a time, he was excommunicated. That was a customary punishment for a monk who takes up arms, and his penance was permanent exile from his beloved Ireland. He must now reach heaven by a voyage of no return, and in his exile he must save as many souls as perished in the battle he precipitated. This was his penance. Columbkill set out, with 12 companions, sailing north beyond the horizon, finally reaching the island of Iona, off the west coast of the land we now call Scotland, just far enough north so that, as Columbkill insisted, there was never a view of Ireland. Now, let us reflect for a moment on the world he left behind, and the world that he and his disciples are sailing toward. The Green Martyrdom had been a failure, both because of the apparently unquenchable Irish tendency to sociability, and perhaps because of the natural fertility of Ireland itself, which possessed nothing resembling an Egyptian desert. So these were no desert fathers. Kenneth Clark, famous for his PBS Civilization series, said, "It's hard to believe that for quite a long time, almost 100 years, Western Christianity survived by clinging to places like Skellig Michael, a pinnacle of rock 18 miles from the Irish coast, rising 700 feet out of the sea." The 100 years he speaks of is from the late 5th century to the late 6th century, by which time the Irish monks had reconnected barbarized Europe to the traditions of Christian literacy. The Western Roman Empire was scarcely a memory now. The last Latin emperor had fallen just a few years after Patrick died. And though there was still a Greek emperor in the east at Constantinople, there was a small defensible state. All the great continental libraries had vanished. Even memory of them had been erased in the minds of those who lived in the emerging feudal societies of medieval Europe. The first 3 public libraries had been established at Rome under the reign of Augustus, and by the time of Constantine, there were 28. By the end of the 4th century, the libraries, like tombs, were closed forever. By the end of the 5th century, at any rate, the profession of copyist has pretty much disappeared. And what books were copied personally by the last literate nobles for their own dwindling libraries. So what did this mean? Ireland was at peace and furiously copying. Thus, it was in the position of becoming Europe's publisher. But the Saxon settlements of southern England, pagan, had cut Ireland off from easy commerce with the continent. A new illiterate Europe rose on its ruins. A vibrant literary culture was blooming in secret along its Celtic fringe. It needed only one step more to close the circle, which would reconnect Europe to its own past by the way of the scribes in Ireland. Columbkill provided that step. By stepping into the coracle that bore him beyond the horizon, he entered the Irish pantheon of heroes who had done immortal deeds against impossible odds. As he sailed off that morning, he was doing the hardest thing an Irishman could do. He was leaving Ireland. All who followed Columbkill's lead were called to the White Martyrdom, never to return. Thus, the Irish monastic tradition began to spread beyond Ireland. Already, Irish monasteries hosted thousands of foreign students who were bringing back Irish learning to their places of origins. Now, Irish monks would themselves colonize barbarized Europe, bringing their learning with them. Scotland, their first outpost, was peopled by indigenous Picts and Irish colonists. The Irish monks were never interested in erecting impressive edifices, great cathedrals. They preferred to spend their time in study, prayer, farming, and of course reading and copying. So the basic plan of the Iona Monastery was quickly executed. A little hut for each monk, an abbot's hut, a refectory, a kitchen, a scriptorium, a library, a smithy, a kiln, a mill, a couple of barns, a modest church, and they were in business. But they needed one more building. The surprising addition of a guest house for the never-ending stream of visitors had begun. Scots, Picts, Irish, Britons, even Anglo-Saxon. They began to pour into this remote island, and many of them never went home again. His reputation spread like wildfire. He made 150 monks the cutoff number for the Iona community. When it was larger than that, 12-in-1 monks would set off to establish another foundation. Fresh applicants kept arriving in droves. By the time of his death, 60 monastic communities had been founded in his name in Scotland. Columbkill's penance was satisfied. He had long since passed his quota of 3,001 souls saved. By the time Columbkill passed away, he had become a model for many others. Monks began to set off in every direction, bent on glorious and heroic exile for the sake of Christ. They were warrior monks, and not afraid of whatever monsters they might meet. Some went north, others northwest, like Brendan the Navigator, who visited Iceland, Greenland, and North America. Some set out in boats without oars, putting their destination completely in the hands of God. Many of the exiles find their way to continental Europe, where they were more than a match for the barbarians they met. They, whom the Romans had never conquered, fearlessly brought the ancient civilization back to its ancient home. Now let's turn our attention from Columbkill to a man 20 years his junior, Columbanus. I once confused Columbanus with Columbkill. They were men of similar abilities and both missionaries of culture. As I said, Columbanus was 20 years younger than Columbkill. In 590, he departed with the requisite 12 companions for Gaul, where he founded in quick succession three forced monasteries. The one at Luxeuil is one of the most important foundations of the early Middle Ages. Such astounding activity could only mean that Columbanus was having similar success to Columbkill in attracting local talents. He did clash with the region's bishops, who were nettled by his presence. These bishops lived urbanely in capital cities and kept close ties with the nobility. They tended their local flocks of semi-literate officials, ghostly remnants of the lost society. The bishops summoned Columbanus to appear before them, but he could not be bothered to take part in such a travesty and sent a letter. To the holy lords and fathers, or better brothers in Christ, the bishops, priests, and remaining orders of Holy Church, I, Columba the sinner, send greeting in Christ. I give thanks to my God that for my sake so many holy men have gathered together to treat of the truth of faith and good works, through senses sharpened to the discernment of good and evil. Would that you did so more often. Columbanus goes on to take the bishops to task for their worldly laxity and lack of industry. Needless to say, he won no friends among the bishops. They had him deported. He was put on board a ship bound for Ireland. When they at last set sail, the ship sank. Columbanus and four companions escaped and survived. Columbanus meant to make his way to northern Italy to convert the Lombards, but while journeying over the Alps, he was forced to stop near Lake Constance because Gall, his expert in Germanic languages, fell ill, refused to go farther. After a heated altercation, Columbus left Gaul behind and with his remaining companions headed for the plains of Lombardy, where they will build at Bobbio, the first Italian-Irish monastery. Vigorous Columbanus, now in his early 70s, did his part in the construction, happily carrying wooden beams on his shoulders. This was in the year 612. Columbanus passed away. He left behind a considerable body of work. Sermons and lectures, playful takes on classical authors, instructions for the brethren, poems and lyrics, including a jolly boat song, and the even larger legacy of his continental monasteries. At this great distance in time, we can no longer be sure exactly how many monasteries were founded in Columbanus' name, but there are many covering a great territory that would become in time the countries of France, Germany, Switzerland, and Italy. Cannot be less than 60, and maybe more than 100. He had been on the continent for just 25 years. These monasteries became a network of universities that shared medical knowledge. They developed the art of science and held scientific conferences. One monastery on which we have some information is that of St. Gall in the Alps, founded by the monk Columbanus had quarreled with and who went on to become the central figure in the founding of the Swiss Church. This was Gall, a more patient man than Columbanus, who went about visiting his neighbors, instructing them in faith and letters. We possess only one of his works, a sermon of such honesty and generosity that you can still grasp what touched those local people. Gall refused the invitation to become Bishop of Constance, and also the invitation to return to the flourishing Luxeuil as its abbot. He stuck to his task, and by the time of his death in 645, all of the local people had received his gospel. One of the greatest of medieval monasteries was built on the site of his labors, named in his honor. In the 9th century, one of his spiritual sons would put together a book containing bits of Gall's favorite reading, notes from a commentary on the Aeneid, excerpts from Jerome and Augustine, some Latin hymns, a little Greek, some natural history, and in Irish his own perfect poem about his cat, Pangerbon. Here it is. I am Pangerbon, my cat. 'Tis a like task we are at. Hunting mice is his delight. Hunting words I sit all night. 'Tis a merry thing to see at our tasks how glad are we when at home we sit and find entertainment to our mind. Against the wall he sets his eye, full and fierce and sharp and sly. Against the wall of knowledge I and all my little wisdom try. So in peace our task we ply, Pangerbon, my cat and I. In our arts we find our bliss. I have mine, and he has his. So that's how the Irish saved us from ourselves. There's a lot we don't know about them, these Irish exiles. A lot of their clay and wattle buildings have long since disappeared, and most of their precious books have disappeared too. However, what they knew, we know, because they passed their knowledge on to us. The Bible, the literatures of Greece and Rome and Ireland. The Hebrew Bible would have been saved without them, transmitted to our time by scattered communities of Jews. The Greek Bible, the Greek commentaries, and much of the literature of ancient Greece were well enough preserved at Byzantium in Constantinople, and might still be available to us, might be, somewhere. But Latin literature would almost surely have been lost without the Irish, and illiterate Europe would have hardly developed its great national literatures without the example of the Irish, the first vernacular literature to be written down. Beyond that, there would have perished in the West not only literacy, but all the habits of mind that encouraged thought. And when Islam began its medieval expansion, it would have encountered scant resistance to its plans. Just scattered tribes of animists ready for a new identity. What a difference the Irish monks made. But I want to praise the white martyrs, those bold missionaries who walked out with books on their belts, clothed like druids in distinctive white wool robes. They fanned out cheerfully across Europe, founding monasteries that would become in time the cities. Salzburg, Vienna, St. Gall, Bobbio, Viesola, and Lucca, Rheinau, Regensburg, Würzburg, many others. I've only named a few. The weight of the Irish influence on the continent is incalculable. These Irish monks saved us. They saved us from becoming disorganized and chaotic tribesmen, helpless before the advance of Islam. As much as any other factor, it was literacy that saved us. We could read, we could write. Scholarly women went on these missions also, but we know even less about them than we know about the men. But there are continental churches dedicated to Bridget in France, Germany, Austria, and Italy that offer some evidence of the presence of women scholars. The monks even made it to Moravia, where an old church has been dug up that looks just like a little church in Glendalough, Ireland. And there are traces of the white martyrs as far as Kiev. A philosopher alive at that time said almost all of Ireland, despising the sea, is migrating to our shores with a herd of philosophers. By this point, the recreation of European culture was assured. Wherever they went, the Irish brought with them their books, many unseen in Europe for centuries, and tied to their waists as a sign of triumph, just as Irish heroes had once tied to their waists their enemies' heads. Wherever they went, they brought their love of learning and their skills in bookmaking. In the bays and valleys of their exile, they reestablished literacy and breathed new life into the exhausted literary culture of Europe. So how did the Irish monks save us from the Muslims? They gave us two gifts, something to fight for and something to fight with. We fought to defend a reborn and refreshed Catholicism, to defend the gift of the fervent Catholicism that they brought with them from the outer edge of the earth. And we were made mighty in battle with a second gift. They brought us the decisive weapon of literacy. Thomas Cahill finishes his book, How the Irish Saved Civilization, in this way. He says, perhaps history is always divided into Romans and Catholics. The Romans are the rich and powerful who run things their way and must always accrue because they instinctively believe that there will never be enough to go around. The Catholics, Catholics spelled with a big C, Catholics spelled with a little c, as their name implies, are universalists who instinctively believe that all humanity makes one family, that every human being is an equal child of God, and that God will provide. The 21st century will be spiritual, or it will not be. If our civilization is to be saved, forget about our civilization, which, as St. Patrick would say, may pass in a moment like a cloud or a smoke that is scattered by the wind. If we are to be saved, it will not be by Romans, but by saints. So once again, we come to the end. This is Chuck Coughlin, a proud descendant of the Irish. And I hope you agree that I've done a small part to set the record straight about the wonderful glory of the Irish monks.
Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
We want to help others, especially in places of strife, such as the Holy Land, where Christianity is dwindling by the day. But how to help? Here's an easy way. Buying products through the Holy Land gift shop. Every product you purchase at myfranciscan.org/shop helps Christians support their families and stay in the Holy Land. Olive wood, embroidery, spices, and many more authentic products from the Holy Land are available right now at myfranciscan.org/shop. The Holy Land Gift Shop, bringing the Holy Land home.
I learned how many people we could help and how good you feel after you've helped others.
I know Lent is about giving, so I want to give.
These kids are talking about CRS Rice Bowl, a Lenten program known by generations of Catholic families. Children love it because they experience different cultures and gain a lasting impression of the people they are helping. You can bring CRS Rice Bowl into your home and experience the joy of seeing your children or grandchildren find new meaning in Lent. Visit crsricebowl.org to get started.
Rice Bowl inspired me to pray more and to pray for those who are less fortunate.
The Cincinnati Catholic Men's Conference is back. Tickets are on sale now for Saturday, April 28th at the Taft Theater at cincinnatimensconference.com or call 513-214-1534. The speaker conference roster is being hailed as one of the best lineups in the country. In rare appearances, come see Father Mitch Pacwa from EWTN, the man motivator Father Larry Richards, former Moeller High School and University of Notre Dame head football coach Jerry Faust, and the big celebrity keynote, Baz Rutan, UFC world champion, MMA world champ, and movie star. The conference theme is What It Means to Be a True Christian Man in Today's Society. Don't miss the incredible day of motivation, spiritual benefit, and fellowship with men from all walks of life. Get tickets now at cincinnatimensconference.com or call 513-214-1534. That's cincinnatimensconference.com or 513-214-1534. Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.